want to talk about the audacity of hope today, because that's what we find in Lamentations 3. It's been pretty dark. It's been a really dark room for Jeremiah. The sky is dark. Life is falling apart. And yet there's a flicker of light and a flicker of hope that comes alive here in chapter 3. I'm sure we've all experienced something like this, where maybe it's towards night, 8, 9, 10 o'clock, and all of a sudden the power just goes out. Could be during a storm. Could be there was an accident somewhere that hit a transformer, but the power in your house goes out. And everybody's kind of scrambling to find a light because it is pitch black in the house. It's really hard to see. And everybody's kind of stumbling around in the dark, bumping in the walls, bumping into the bed. And right there in the darkness, somebody finds maybe their cell phone or a flashlight and they flick it on. And there in the middle of the darkness, it's small. It's so small. But all of a sudden, there's a little bit of light. That's what Lamentations 3 is about for Jeremiah. He's stumbling around in the dark. He's doing it in the presence of God. And all of a sudden, there's a little spark, just a little spark, that tells us there's hope to be found. It's the audacity of hope. And so what I want to do today is we talk about how we find hope in our grief, is to give you maybe four or five truths as time allows, things that should encourage us or will encourage us as we grieve and we look towards God. So I want to jump right in today, very little introduction, jump right in. Here's the five. Let me start with one. And let's start off with the comprehensive nature of Lamentations. And let's just say this. The very first thing we see in Lamentations 3 and chapter 2 is God extends a very broad invitation for us to lament. In other words, the invitation is sent very wide. That it doesn't matter who in our life is hurting, whether it's us or somebody else, God invites us into his presence to pray and cry out before him in prayer. We can take all of our raw emotions before God, regardless of the situation we find ourselves in. So let me just kind of show you a couple of things here. Let's state the obvious, first of all. And the obvious is, notice that Jeremiah is weeping for the pain he has in his own life. Look at chapter 3, verse 1. I am the man who has seen affliction. You ever feel like that? I am the person who has seen affliction. I am the man of sorrows. Jeremiah feels like God is against him to some degree, and he feels a lot of affliction and a lot of pain. The very first thing we can say, it's obvious, but it's important, is Jeremiah is crying out to God for the pain in his own life. That's not viewed as selfish. That's not discouraged. That's something we should do. When we feel pain, we go to God. We'll take it a step further. Last week we said, as we weep for our own hurts and pains, we can do that even when we feel guilty. Even when we have contributed to some of the damage that's causing a problem in our lives. I can tell you as a pastor, and I can tell you as a person, that I deal with this just like everybody else. I sit across from someone who loses a job, they have no way to provide for their family, and the reason is because they stole from the company. Or maybe a deal went south, and they just kind of laid off the deal so long, they feel guilty about what happened. Sometimes we are a victim of our own kind of self-inflicted wounds. That's what the book of Lamentations is about. There are innocent people in Lamentations, but there's not that many of them. Most of them have caused some of the destruction in their community and are now reaping the benefits, so to speak. What's powerful about the book of Lamentations is Jeremiah is crying out despite the fact that he and his people are guilty. Despite the fact that they've contributed to this. What does this tell us? This tells us we should be like the prodigal son who caused a mess of his own making and yet said, I will arise and go to my father. It's true. Sometimes we find ourselves as victims, don't we? You didn't do anything for the economy to go south. You didn't do anything for a disease to come into the family. There's a lot of times we're victims, but there's a lot of times we're not. And we do things that contribute to some of the damage in our lives. It can be substance abuse. It can be damaging things to our marriage. Screaming at our kids and it causes rifts in the family. In those moments, what do? We don't just go to God with our pain when we're innocent victims. We go all the more when we find ourselves full of guilt. He's a God of grace. He's a God of love. We need to be like the prodigal and say, I will arise and go to my father. The great thing about chapter 2, we said, is verse 19 says, arise, cry out in the night. And that comes on the hills of Jeremiah telling every one of them, you are terribly guilty. You're terribly guilty. Despite that, arise and cry out to God. I'll take it a step further, though, something that's encouraging to me. Not only does Jeremiah cry out for his own pain, and not only does he tell Israel, you cry out despite your guilt, but there's a real conflict in Jeremiah's life. He is crying out despite weakness of faith. Check out the passage that was read. Look at verse 19 of chapter 3. Let me back up and say, how about verse 16? He has made my teeth grind on gravel. I'll get to that in a minute. Doesn't sound good, though. He's made me cower in ashes. My soul is bereft of peace. You ever feel like you just can't find peace, no matter what you do? I have forgotten what happiness is. So I say, my endurance has perished. So has my hope from the Lord. Jeremiah says, I have no hope, I have no faith. Remember my affliction and wanderings, the wormwood and gall. My soul continually remembers it and is bowed down before me. Jeremiah says, I have absolutely no hope. Verse 21, oh, wait a minute. But this I recall to mind, so I have hope. What's interesting about Lamentations 3, and we're going to see this for the rest of the book, is Jeremiah is now being pulled between two poles. I don't feel much hope. Wait a minute, I have a lot of hope. I don't feel a lot of hope. Wait a minute, I have hope in God. What's happening in Lamentations is a struggle that happens with every one of us. It's called a lack of faith, you know? It's called, I know God is on the throne, but I'm having a really hard time believing that. And I know God tells me he'll forgive me, and I should come to him in prayer, but I have a hard time really believing he's going to hear me. Jeremiah's emotions are up, down throughout the book of Lamentations. He is weak in faith, and here's the key. He not only brings all his guilt and his shame before God, he even goes with weakness of faith. He brings his weakness of faith before God. God will bless Jeremiah and give him hope, not because he's a man full of faith, but because he's one that's willing to step in the direction of God despite his lack of faith. Sometimes we feel like, why would I go to God? I don't have enough faith. I'm really struggling. I've had a bad day. I feel hopeless. Happiness is nowhere to be found. And you don't feel like you're qualified to go into the presence of God until you reach a certain level of faith. But Jeremiah shows us we should step in the direction of God regardless of where our level of faith is. Because here's the key. How much faith you have, frankly, is pretty irrelevant. The direction of your faith is everything. You got a mustard seed? Put it in the direction of God. It's a great passage, by the way, where Jesus... disciples are all terrified. And I don't know if you remember what he said to them. He doesn't say, how much faith do you have? He says, where is your faith? What direction is it in? Jeremiah here is crying out. It's a great passage in Mark 9. I go back to this a lot in my own life. There's a man whose son is possessed by a demon, and the man is just tormented over the pain in his son's life. Son is throwing himself on the ground. He's doing cutting and self-injury and self-harm. And Jesus is in the vicinity. Jesus shows up, and the man calls upon Jesus. He laments, essentially, goes before Jesus and cries his heart out to Jesus. And Jesus looks at him and says, he says this. He says, everything is possible for those that believe. Well, that's nice, but what about us that are having trouble believing, right? And I think the man at that moment is saying, well, is that all you got? You know, but this is what the man does, and I love this. He looks at Jesus, and he says, I believe. Help thou my unbelief. How's that? How's that for a borderline contradiction? I believe, help thou my unbelief. What is the man saying? The man is saying, Lord, I don't have much faith. I don't have much faith. But what I do have, I'm coming before you. And I'm asking Jesus to help. How much you have faith-wise is rather irrelevant if it's in the wrong direction, isn't it? You can have all the faith you want in the world that a bridge is going to hold you. But if you go over that bridge and the bridge is weak and it collapses, your faith did nothing to save you. On the other hand, you can come up to an old rickety bridge that you don't think will save you, but you know you have to cross it. And you get in your car and you drive across and you hear the creaks and the cracks and the boards are cracking, but you make it across. As weak as your faith was, you put it in the right direction. We are saved not by the strength of our faith, but by the object of our faith. See, that's what Jeremiah is learning. He's learning whatever little faith I have, I can bring it before God. I can find confidence in him. So Jeremiah weeps for himself. Number two, he also weeps for innocent people. There are a lot of innocent people that this tragedy has fallen upon. Here's just one example I put in for us to think about. What about the children? Poor children. Chapter 2, verse 11. My eyes are spent weeping. My stomach churns. My bile is poured out to the ground because of the destruction of the daughter of my people. Because infants and babies faint in the streets of the city. They cry to their mothers, where is bread and wine? They faint like a wounded man in the streets. Their life is poured out in their mother's bosom. Jeremiah realized it's not just infants and babies, but it's at least infants and babies. There's a lot of innocent people in the world that did nothing to deserve any kind of invasion at all. They didn't make geopolitical decisions. They didn't invite something into their lives that caused destruction. It's just brought upon them because of the decisions of other people in their families and in their community, and frankly, at the time, among the kings and the prophets and the priests. I'll give you one thought here, just something to chew on a little bit. There is an inescapable principle the Bible brings out, and we don't like to believe it because we're Western people, but it's true. Our decisions affect other people. They affect innocent people. The Western cultural narrative is something like, you know, I'm free to live as I want so long as I don't hurt anybody else. It's impossible to live as you want so long as you don't hurt anybody else. We think that we can be islands unto ourselves and just say, Lord, I'm going to seal myself off. I'll make my decisions over here, and it will not affect anybody in my family or my community. There's nothing that can be done in the dark that does not affect people in the light to some degree. Our cultural narrative is I'm free to live as I want. And I imagine that's what people said. And Jeremiah points out, as he weeps for the babies, it's going to affect people down the road. The church should never say we're free to make our own decisions. We don't have to think about the community. Fathers, we never say that. We never say what I do in secret will not affect my family in the light. Mothers, we never say things like that. Children, we never say things like that. It's the cultural narrative of the West, but it's not the cultural narrative of the gospel. There's an old movie. I actually read the article about it, an article on Calvary, it's called. Brendan Gleeson plays a priest. As the article goes on, there were a couple of lines in there that stuck out to me. His daughter of the priest, fails in a suicide attempt. And she looks at her father and says, I belong to myself, not to anybody else. What is she really saying? She's saying, my life is mine and I can do what I want, even harming my own self. It's all about me and I can make these decisions as long as it doesn't hurt anybody else. And the priest, Brandon Gleason, what does he say? He says, true and false. What does he mean by that? He says, it's a tired old argument, I suppose, but what about those you'll leave behind? Now, here's something the daughter probably never thought of. That may sound good in your own mind, but in reality, your decision to strike a blow on yourself will inflict pain in the family that will never be healed, ever. For generations, maybe. And Brendan Gleeson is asking, do you have the right to darken our lives this way? Do you have the right to darken the life of your siblings this way? Do you have the right to darken the life of your community this way? See, the cultural narrative of the West is, I can do whatever I want with my body and my decisions and my life so long as it doesn't affect other people. And the gospel narrative says, that's impossible to do. That's impossible to do. Because the decisions you make in the dark, even if they're in the dark, will always affect people in the light. We're interconnected. We're in relationships. Life just doesn't work that way. The fact of the matter is, we are not islands unto ourselves. Our world and our families and our community are part of an ecosystem. And whether we like it or not, we are in that relationship ecosystem. And you cannot upset one part of the ecosystem without it upsetting part of the ecosystem of relationships over here. So nobody in the church ever says, shouldn't say, the church is free to do what she wants, I'm free to do what I want. By the way, the whole idea of I can do whatever I want as long as I don't hurt anybody else, I can do whatever I want with my body, I can do whatever I want in my life. You know what we do here when we take the Lord's Supper? We repeat something Jesus said. This is my body which is broken for you. You know what Jesus didn't say in the Lord's Supper? This is my body. I can do anything I want in my body as long as my decisions don't hurt other people. The gospel narrative is counter to that. The world keeps telling you that you can do whatever you want because you own it and it's your decisions. And yet the gospel comes at least once a month the way of the Lord's Supper and gives you a different narrative to live by. One where you're not just thinking you're an island unto yourself and you can make decisions, but what Jesus did. My body is not about me. My life is not about me. It's about loving God and serving people around me. It's a profoundly different countercultural narrative to the world. Jeremiah is weeping for the innocent people in his community. We should weep for those who are affected by tragedy. I want to go a step further. We touched on this but didn't get to it last week. Jeremiah is weeping for guilty people. This is important. He's not just weeping for himself. He's not just weeping for innocent. He's weeping for other people that are also suffering from the self-inflicted wounds. Take a look at 48, verses 48 through 49 of chapter 3. And the prophet says, again, here's this language from chapter 2. My eyes will overflow without ceasing, without response. He talks about, rather 48, my eyes flow with rivers of tears because of the destruction of my daughter of Jerusalem. My eyes flow with ceasing, without respite. He is not just crying for his own life. He's crying for his community. He is weeping for the people who inflicted self-inflicted wounds on themselves. Man, if ever there was a time to say, I told you so, this would be a good one, wouldn't it? I mean, for like a couple decades, Jeremiah has been in the town square going, this is coming. God said it's coming if we don't turn back to him. And when it finally comes, if ever there's an aha moment, I told you so, it's this one. But Jeremiah is not moved with pride. He's moved with a great degree of humility. Sometimes when we look out into the world, we divide the world into those are victims over there, and I'm going to cry and weep and sympathize with those, but these people over here that made decisions to destroy their life and destroy their community, they don't deserve a bit of my compassion. Or if they get my compassion, it's going to be very limited. Jeremiah is downright lasciviousness with his compassion. He's prodigal with his compassion. He cares about people because he knows God cares about people. He's weeping with those that weep even when they contributed to the poor decisions. Now, I'm going to get really practical with you here, okay? I need this as a pastor. I'm going to tell you what I'm about to tell you. I preach to myself harder this week than ever before. Most of the time when something happens in our country or in somebody's life, we feel like we need an investigative report before we can pray and weep. Here's what I mean by that. Well, we read something in the paper, a national tragedy happens. Maybe we read about a family, they're struggling. Or you read about a son that leaves the home. Whatever it is, most of the time we think, I don't know who to pray for. I don't know who to weep for. Somebody's innocent and somebody's guilty, or it's 50-50 or something like that. I need more information before I can cry out to God. But if we're going to be like Jeremiah, who's downright lascivious in his compassion, we should be the kind of people that cry out no matter what. You don't need an investigative report to cry out. If there's a terrorist attack, it doesn't matter who's guilty. It doesn't matter who's innocent. Cry out to the hurting people. When there's a shooting, someone lost a son. A community lost a member. There's a lot of details that swirl around. We want to be the kind of people that are quick to weep with those that weep wherever we find brokenness. And sometimes we get way too political about this, trying to parse out who's innocent, who's guilty. RBC, we don't need an investigative report to weep with those that weep. We cry. Our tears flow, as Jeremiah says. Our eyes fill with rivers of tears where we see brokenness. Let me give you a second point. Invitation is so wide. But I want you to know that the confidence Jeremiah has, despite the appearance, and I'll show you why in a minute, Jeremiah is confident. He is going to weep as people who have the ear of God. That's a little ironic. Take a look at the text. The first 21 verses tell us there's a terrible judgment. So let's not run from this judgment idea. Because if you're like me, you're like, judgment. I don't want to talk about judgment, right? Let's embrace it for a minute because it's in the text, okay? 21 verses. There are at least seven pictures of judgment. The first one is that of a shepherd. Look at verse 1. I am the man who has seen affliction under the rod of his wrath. That word rod is a shepherd picture. The staff and the rod. You know the 23rd Psalm, right? Thy rod and thy staff, they comfort me. Those are two things the shepherd would carry. The staff is just what you think of, that long candy cane looking thing the shepherds would have. That staff is fantastic, by the way. They would not only herd the sheep with it. You know what shepherds do? Shepherds will take that staff and touch the individual sheep. It's a way of making personal contact with their sheep. And shepherds tell us that as they walk with their sheep, they'll take that staff and just lay it on the back of the sheep as they walk. And that's just a way of letting the sheep know, I'm with you here. It's kind of a little symbol of affection between the shepherd. That's what God does with us. He shepherds the flock. He guides us. He leads us. He touches us. We're in a relationship with him. The rod itself is the rod of protection. The rod is what you hit the wolves with. Philip Keller, when he talks about the rod, he wrote a big bit about shepherds and sheep and how it relates to Scripture. And he says the rod really came to light. He says these little Maasai boys, these are kids in the East that help the shepherds. He said they're experts, even at a young age, with the rod. He said, I was standing there, and one of them had a rod. You're talking about a two-foot little rod. And a little snake, rattlehead snake or something, peeks its head up and is about to bite a sheep. He says, and he whipped it from all the way across and smacked it in the head and protected the sheep just like that. He talks about how skilled these little boys are, even with the rod, never mind the shepherd. The point to appreciate, the rod is a symbol of judgment. And the rod is a symbol of protection. What's ironic in this passage is who is the one that feels like he's getting the rod? Yeah. I am the man under affliction, under the rod of his wrath. Jeremiah is saying that same rod that we Israel used to think was going to protect us, we are now under that rod. There's a rod of judgment. Another thing here we see is the darkness. Think about verse 2. He has driven me, brought me out into darkness. Got the word again in verse 6. I dwell in darkness. Now, what is darkness a symbol of? You know the plagues of Egypt, right? One of those is a plague of darkness. It's a symbol of judgment. What does it mean when Jesus is on the cross and darkness comes over the land? It's a symbol, of course, of some kind of judgment. Just think about the Lion King. You know, even in fiction, the Lion King, when Simba goes off, what happens to the land? The land falls under a certain darkness until the right king comes back. It's under darkness. Darkness is a symbol of judgment. Jeremiah is painting a picture of judgment here. Here's a tough one. He feels like he's buried alive. Verse 4, he's made my flesh and my skin waste away, my bones, broken my bones. He's besieged, enveloped me, bitterness and tribulation. He's made me dwell in darkness like the dead of long ago. He feels like he's being buried alive. He feels like he's 6 feet under. He feels like he's in a prison, verse 7. He's walled me about so I cannot escape. And we're not talking about the kind of prison that you and I have in mind, bad as that may be. We're talking about ancient prisons, subterranean prisons. I'll tell you what, it's a real tragedy. Over in East Granby, Connecticut, I think they closed it. Maybe it's not a tragedy. Maybe I'll visit next week if it's open. There's Old Newgate Prison. You ever been to Old Newgate Prison? Oh, I visited that as a kid. I think it's 1705 when it was opened as some kind of mine, and it was almost immediately turned into a subterranean prison, an early American subterranean prison. You walk into Old Newgate Prison and you get this feel of what an ancient subterranean prison would be like. Got chains hanging off the walls, some water dripping down. Jeremiah feels like he is in this ancient subterranean prison that God has put him in there. He feels like he's being hunted, verse 10 through 13. He feels like he's a spectacle in verse 14. I become the laughingstock of all people. He feels like Hester, right, in the Scarlet Letter. Here's that verse we read earlier. He's made, verse 16, my teeth grind on gravel. He's covered me with ashes. What does that mean, he's made my teeth grind on gravel? You know what they would do is they take a prisoner of war. Most of the ancient cultures did something like this. If you're a prisoner of war, when they fed you your food, they'd mix gravel in with it. And the point was, you'd really have to pick it out the best you could and eat. And nevertheless, at some point, you're going to break a tooth. And Jeremiah feels like he's being fed this prisoner of war kind of gravel. Jeremiah is describing the judgment of God. That's why in verse 3, he says, again and again, he's turned his hand against me. This feels very abandoned by God. Now, let me make a point about this. If you have a pulse, I'm guessing you do because you're here, this offends our sensibilities a little bit, doesn't it? We don't like to think of God as any kind of judge. Our Western world doesn't like to think of God as any kind of judge. But I would say, worse than that, there is a theological paradox you have to work through. Here's why. Because if Jeremiah is guilty and his people are guilty, and he knows God is judging them, how in the world can he get to the rest of the passage where he recalls something to mind and has hope? See, that's the problem. Jeremiah knows he's under the judgment. There is a judgment for sin, but Jeremiah still has hope. How can that be? It's a theological paradox. If you're in a situation and deep down inside you know you had something to do with it and you're guilty, how can you possibly cry out to God? Or is lamenting only for good moral people who don't commit sins? If that's the case, what do the rest of us do, right? Now, here's where I'm going with this. This is why Christians, even those who find their sensibilities kind of challenged, are very slow to dismiss the judgment language for this reason. Lamentations 3 is what theologians call prophetic shadowing, foreshadowing. You know what that means? The judgment that Jeremiah is describing fell on Jesus at the cross. Lamentations 3 is Isaiah. Remember in Isaiah, he is wounded for our transgressions. He was afflicted on our behalf. You know, in Psalm 22, my God, why hast thou forsaken me? David said that, but Jesus spoke it on the cross. The reason Christians do not dismiss the judgment language in Lamentations 3 is because we firmly believe the judgment of God that's described here so graphically fell upon Jesus on the cross. The innocent one on the cross received the judgment of God so we who are guilty can go to God and lament and cry and pray, and we can do it boldly because there is no double jeopardy with God. Who is the man who is under affliction? Look at verse 1 one more time. Isn't this unusual? I am the man who has seen affliction. Isn't it odd that Jeremiah talks about the nation of Israel as one man? Who's the man under affliction? Who's the man under affliction in the New Testament? Jesus. Jesus is feeling the judgment of God on the cross so you and I could go freely to the throne of grace. The innocent Jesus ignored in his cry so that we guilty could be heard by God in ours. Here's my point. Most people, they find confidence in their prayer lives by confessing their goodness. I haven't done that much bad. I'm a pretty good person. I'm moral. I'm upstanding. I've had a good day, and therefore God will hear me when I pray. Christians never do that. Not if we're in our right senses, right? What do? We embrace it and we confess it. I am a sinner. I am worthy of judgment, some kind of judgment, but Jesus took that on the cross, and therefore I can go to God and I can pray. We don't have to hide it. We don't have to pretend it's not there. That's why a lot of people try to dismiss judgment language in the Bible. Christians rarely do, shouldn't do, because we realize that judgment fell on Jesus on the cross for us. I'll close with one thought, and this is a beautiful one. You know, the book of Hebrews, open with this verse. We come boldly unto the throne of grace. That's what's happening in Lamentations 3. Jeremiah is coming boldly unto the throne of grace. I was thinking about this morning. You could describe the throne of God any way you want. At least the writers could. He could have called it the throne of righteousness. But I can only tell you, that does not inspire me to come. Because if he's righteous and I'm not, we got a problem. And the problem's on my end. He could call it the throne of beauty. That would be an accurate description. But the writer of Hebrews says, we come boldly with confidence to the throne of grace. If you believe that God saves people because they're good and moral and religious, we have a real problem. We'll always stutter step on our way to that God. I will. I'm not going near that God. If we believe that God receives us through Christ because his grace, his compassion, here's Lamentations, mercies are new every morning, his loving kindness, despite the self-inflicted wounds in this life, metaphorically speaking, despite all that we've done, we can go to God. We can go to God.